When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Summer is usually a great time for food choices for people in Wisconsin. Backyard gardens, farmers markets, grocery stores brimming with fresh produce. But for a lot of people, they don't have those choices because school is not in session. A lot of kids get their nutrition during the school year, so we need your help. St. Vincent de Paul has a food pantry that gives your neighbor in need some of the same choices you have. But to keep it going, we need your help, your donations, support the food pantry. And you can do one of a couple things. Drop off an extra bag of groceries from the store or your local farmer's market. Also, a $50 cash donation feeds a family of five for a week. You can organize a food drive, whatever it takes to keep that food pantry going this summer while the kids are at home. Let's do what we can. Here's what you do. You contact St. Vincent de Paul at svdpmadison.org. That's svdpmadison.org. Let's work on this together. Welcome to another podcast at sliceoffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. John Nichols from the Capital Times with us. Brother, you know, so much focus has been put on this investigation with Russians and their entanglement with the Trump campaign meddling in our election that it's almost hard to believe. But you remember there was a time when we were saying, well, you know, the one thing about Trump is he might not be as bad as a Paul Ryan or Mike Pence when it comes to the budget. Well, we're learning that he's actually just as bad, if not worse.
Oh, I think actually worse. And you see, this is the lie that people tell themselves. People who, frankly, don't want to get serious about dealing with the mess we're in. They say, well, you know, yeah, well, Pence would be worse. Or Ryan, you know, boy, if you got rid of Trump, you know, these other guys would be worse. There's zero evidence of that. They're all awful, okay? So what you're really talking about is only, you know, a question of how they present their awfulness. And the fact of the matter is that Trump is confidently awful, okay? Whereas there's a reasonable chance that Pence and Ryan would be less confidently awful. And so at some fundamental level, I find it unsettling when I hear Democrats or progressives say, oh, well, you know, it would be worse if Trump wasn't there. That's not true. If Trump was impeached or in some other way removed, if he stepped down, if, you know, he was just fully disempowered electorally, whatever model you went, the Republicans themselves would broadly be harmed. It would divide their political movement between the suit and tie right-wingers like Ryan and Pence and Trump's base. There would be a distrust there. There'd be all sorts of collapse in their false coalition or their coalition around power rather than any sort of principle. So, you know, I think this budget is an atrocious budget. It looks to me to have less to do with Donald Trump than with Paul Ryan and Mulvaney and perhaps Pence. But this is a wish list for the people who know the least about economics on the planet. And, you know, I know that sounds like a little bit of hyperbole. So let me dial that back to be gentle here. There are probably some children at, you know, like preschool who know a little less about economics than these guys.
Well, that's very gentle of you. Here's the coverage from NBC last night.
Save Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security without cuts. Have to do it.
President Trump promised he would protect the safety net, but his first budget released today wouldn't do that, instead making deep cuts over the next decade. $72 billion from Social Security disability insurance, and at least $610 billion from Medicaid. The cuts could devastate Americans like Adrian Gunter, who has multiple sclerosis.
My Medicaid coverage takes the burden away from endless medical bills.
The administration's defense.
We're not going to measure compassion by the amount of money that we spend, but by the number of people that we help.
President Trump's $4.1 trillion plan would make good on a series of other promises, including infrastructure, paid parental leave, defense, and border security, including a $1.6 billion down payment for the border wall. President Trump says he can do all that, cut taxes, and still balance the budget in 10 years. But that assumes the economy will grow even faster than it did in the booming 1990s. The plan landed today in Congress with a thud. Some in the GOP echoing the number two Senate Republican leader, John Cornyn, who warned it could be dead on arrival.
Is it dead on arrival?
Yes.
Is this budget dead on arrival?
I don't think I've served in Congress ever where somebody didn't say that about a president's budget.
The president's budget is going to set the contours for Republicans to consider, but at the end of the day, it's the Republicans in Congress who are going to write the heart and guts of this budget.
Would that be a kabuki dance that's going on? What's going on? Give me a little insight here.
Well, there's a lot going on there, first off. I love the Paul Ryan line. I don't think...
Yeah, you're talking about the coward from Rock County?
Yeah.
I've named him after that Kenny Rogers song, only he's the coward of Rock County.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, exactly. Rode in on his beat-up horse. But, so, here's the deal. He just said, well, I don't think I've ever been in Congress where a president's budget hasn't been... where a president's budget hasn't been declared dead on arrival, right? And the interesting thing about that is, do you know why? Because they're all dead on arrival. You know, I mean, it's an accurate statement. But, you know, he suggests it like it's some sort of weird fantasy that they're dead on arrival. No, they're dead on arrival. That's just the way of it. And there's no question of that. It's not a debatable point. But some of the other things that were said there, you know, it's just, look, here's the bottom line. The reason that budget's dead on arrival is because it's a Paul Ryan budget, right? What Ryan and other people don't say is what makes this budget so unpopular that most Republicans will oppose it or, you know, at least try to rewrite it in some way. Is because it's what they say. It's actually what they say they'll do. It's an extension of who they are. And what they say they will do is cut things that shouldn't be cut, right? They're always threatening to cut things that shouldn't be cut and put tremendous amounts of money into things that don't need tremendous amounts of money, right? So they redistribute money in the worst of ways. And then... they also make, as a priority above all this, to stream massive amounts of money out of the process, you know, out of the things, to give tax breaks to their campaign donors, right? They always, always do that. And then finally, and this is the worst part of it, they don't even acknowledge that this will cause massive, massive deficits, that this will harm, you know, not just... the economy, right, in severe ways, but it will also harm, you know, the country itself. It will do long-term harm economically to, you know, how we progress as a nation. And you say, well, yeah, but all he's going to do is run up a lot of debt, and it's nice that he's going to spend some money and stuff like that. Well, this is where the problem comes in. The cuts that they propose, the actions they propose, are immensely unpopular. The president himself is in severe political trouble. And his international trip is becoming literally a source of comedy, not just in the U.S., but globally.
The Pope looked really happy to see him today.
Boy, and you know, did you see those comparison pictures of the Pope with Obama versus the Pope with, oh my gosh. But, so, you know, he's got a lot of problems on his hands. And all this suggests that there's a pretty good chance that the Republicans could get beat. In fact, there's some recent just election results from yesterday that are quite interesting from legislative districts around the country. And also, that Trump himself would be out of office. And then this is where it goes really awful. After being voted out of office, after being defeated politically, then these same people will scream and yell about deficits and debts. And they'll say, gotta bring everything to a halt because we've got such massive debts and deficits. Well, you know, this is the interesting thing. It's the oldest pattern of all. Conservatives, and that's the dangerous bunch. It's not just Republicans. You have to understand it's this conservative political ideology are so dishonest that they run up massive debts. Reagan did it. Bush, the son, did it. I mean, these people, they run up massive debts. They put things off the books. They lie about their budgets, right? And then when they hand it off to somebody else, they do everything they can to blame the next person for the crisis they created.
Yeah, we've really seen this the last 36 years. All right, let me play a clip here of Elizabeth Warren.
It appears that their view of compassion is that we make sure that we can knock 24 million people off health care coverage, that we take the legs out from underneath Medicaid, which one of the principal users are seniors who are in nursing homes, who otherwise have no alternatives and no way to pay for nursing home care. And that somehow he thinks he's going to get in front of that with a statement about compassion. This is beyond farce. Look at things like what they want to do to education, that Betsy DeVos and Donald Trump now propose about an $11 billion cut to public education. And among the programs that they just want to cut out any federal help for are things like AP classes, foreign languages, physical education, even support for the Special Olympics. Let's zero all of those out. And for young people who are trying to go to college, they want to take the whole loan forgiveness program that's there for people who've decided to go into public service, who've said, I'm going to work for a lower paying job in public service, and the American taxpayers have said, okay, we'll do a little loan forgiveness to help you pay your college debts off. No, zero that program out. Take good programs like Gear Up and TRIO that help students get into college and make it through college, kids who might not have otherwise had that chance. Zero that program out. Increase the cost of student loans for low-income students. It's like one punch in the face after another.
Sorry, that was a long clip, but they're doing a lot of damage.
Nice line, the one punch in the face after another.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that pretty well. Yeah, she's got a good turn of phrase there. And, you know, she's right. She's right about the severe damage that is done. And the only thing I'd add to the mix here is that perhaps the even deeper damage that is done is not two specific programs, the loss of this loan forgiveness program or the loss of this college prep program or all the other things that would move us, you know, that might help to move us a little bit forward. It is also the failure to invest anew, the failure to be putting money into the next stage initiatives that have to be done. And, you know, this is a little bit of a criticism of President Obama. President Obama was in so many ways, very likable president, certainly, you know, dramatically more reasonable on every level than Donald Trump. But in part because he had such a recalcitrant Republican Congress that wouldn't cooperate with him, and also just in part because of the, you know, kind of stick-in-the-mud nature of the Democratic Party at this point, they didn't begin to invest in realistic ways to prepare for an age of automation, that the next stages of our economy that are going to be incredibly unsettling and perhaps very, very challenging for this country. So you get a double whammy here. Not only is Trump undoing or proposing to undo the good things that are on the books, he is also proposing a budget that doesn't begin to look to the future at all. And what it ends up doing by is put the United States in a position where we will be playing catch-up with the rest of the world. And
by the way,
the rest of the world is not going to pause and wait for us anymore.
By the way, while he's taken office, have there been any new coal mines that have opened? And has the exodus of jobs stopped out of the country? Has he negotiated a fair trade deal for the country? I'm just wondering.
He hasn't, and he won't, because remember,
he's a billionaire.
Unfortunately for Donald Trump, the clock keeps ticking, right? He can't. The stuff he promised in the campaign were promises that needed to be made and kept in the 1990s. We should have undone NAFTA in the 1990s. We should never have done China free trade the way we did. I mean, there's a lot of, criticism of these trade deals. Spy, you and I were criticizing these trade deals before Donald Trump knew they existed. But the fact of the matter is we have now moved a quarter century ahead from when it was time to do smart trade policy. Now, what Trump proposes is to go back and argue about things that were already wrecked. It would be like after a car crash, you argue about the color of the car. And he is nothing in his initiatives are going to solve these problems. That's not what we need at this point.
I'm even more concerned because the Washington Post today talks about the fact that in his infrastructure project, he's talking about privatizing bridges and privatizing railways.
It's a grifter scam. It's a grifter scam. In fact, several of the people who've run infrastructure programs in previous administrations have been the most critical of this. They're literally sending the alarm bell up saying, this isn't going to, A, give us a good infrastructure, or B, provide any kind of reasonable return on investment. What this is a scam to move tremendous amounts of money via tax breaks and other schemes into the accounts of, Trump's friends and campaign donors. You're going to get very little infrastructure for an immense amount of cost. That's the reality of the situation we're in.
Sean Nichols from the Capital Times with us at SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
We're back at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Well, there was some movement quite a day with John Brennan testifying before Congress. There were a couple of stunning things that happened, including the Trump National Security Team essentially admitting that Donald Trump has contacted them. They didn't say so yesterday, but their silence spoke golden about his efforts to squash this investigation. But before we get started, Rush Limbaugh was trying to discredit John Brennan today because he's convinced that John Brennan voted for Gus Hall in 1976 and that he's now a Muslim.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Now, whether either of those things are true or not, I don't think either of them.
You cannot be serious.
I very much doubt that they're true. I'm just
Limbaugh's not saying that. That's too much.
He said
it. Buy it.
He said it.
I don't buy it.
Well, he said it. He said it with a straight face. I just had to tell you. Okay. Here is John Brennan yesterday.
I was convinced in the summer that the Russians were trying to interfere in the election. And they were very aggressive. It was a multifaceted effort. And I wanted to make sure that we were able to expose as much of that as possible.
But was there intelligence that said that the Trump campaign was colluding with Moscow during their campaign?
There was intelligence that the Russian intelligence services were actively involved in this effort. And having been involved in many counterintelligence cases in the past, I know what the Russians try to do. They try to suborn individuals, and they try to get individuals, including U.S. persons, to act on their behalf, either wittingly or unwittingly. And I was worried by a number of the contacts that the Russians had with U.S. persons, and so therefore, by the time I left office on January 20th, I had unresolved questions in my mind as to whether or not the Russians had been successful in getting U.S. persons involved in the campaign or not to work on their behalf, again, either in a witting or unwitting fashion. And so, therefore, I felt as though the FBI investigation was certainly well-founded and needed to look into those issues.
Quite a significant moment yesterday.
It sure was. I mean, that was, it's an interesting question that kind of sparked it all off. Did you see this? And I hope I get the word right. Was it coordination that they asked about, or collaboration?
Right.
And then what Brennan did was he didn't quite answer the question. What he said was, you know, look, here are the facts I've got. Here's how I extrapolate from how I build out on those facts. And this is one of the kind of complexities of the discourse at this point, right? Because you have some folks who say, well, the only way you're going to prove anything of consequence is if you have, you know, a picture of Trump sitting at a table or video of Trump sitting at a table with the Russians saying, here's how we're going to run this campaign, right? But that's not how intelligence works. And that's not how, you know, frankly, spying works. The fact of the matter is that what Brennan did there was illustrate a lot of the kind of deep reality here. You don't know everything. And it's a great struggle to get to knowing most things, but you build on your experience. You build on what certainly appears to be the case. You investigate based on that, because you don't investigate things that have already happened, that you've already proven. You investigate to try and figure out exactly what is going on. And then ultimately, in cases like this, what happens is you find somebody who was at the table or who was near the table.
Well, this is what the FBI is doing right now.
Yes, and that's why messing with their investigation, firing the director of the FBI at the point that it was, and these other initiatives, you know, and this attempt by Trump to get people to declare that he, Trump, is not under investigation, his claims, you know, all this stuff like this. You know, this is why it's such an unsettling thing, why people do use the term obstruction of justice, because it's an attempt not merely structurally, or appears to be an attempt to mangle some of these investigations, to undermine them, but it's also an attempt to lie to the American people, to make the American people think that things have to operate in a certain way that has nothing to do with national security, but has everything to do with politics.
Here's another moment from yesterday.
Director, there is what is referred to as consciousness of guilt evidence. That's when somebody lies about a material fact, and that fact, the fact of them lying, can be used against that person because it would be, in essence, an effort to cover up what happened, meaning if, you know, you were telling the truth, you wouldn't have anything to cover up. With respect to some of the contacts that you've referred to between Russia and Trump campaign officials, are you aware of any of those U.S. persons who had contacts with Russia either making false statements about those contacts or failing to disclose those contacts?
I think that's something that you can we can pursue in a closed session.
Wow. What is that? Because he can't say yes without the follow-up question, right? You know, which is, can you give us some names here? And when you're sitting there at the table, that's where it becomes problematic. But boy, you know, this is where it gets to this complex point. I have said throughout this process that we should be cautious. We should not make too many assumptions, right? And, you know, you should hear what the facts are. Don't assume that it's as bad as, you know, some, you know, Democratic operative claims it is, right? And then when you get to the testimony, it looks to be as bad or worse.
Well, this is remarkable. Here's another moment yesterday. NIH Director Dan Coats. there's about a 9-second pause here.
Have you talked about this issue with Admiral Rogers?
That is something that I would like to withhold that question at this particular point in time.
I'm going to assume that in withholding the question, the implicit answer is that yes, you have. And I would like to know in another setting, if necessary, what the substance of that conversation was.
Well, now, so yesterday the story came out that, in fact, that, you know, Trump was calling his entire national security team trying to basically push back on this, and that... I'm sorry. That's
trying to get them to lie,
right,
on his behalf.
Yeah. That's pretty remarkable. But how'd you like that? How'd you like that pause from Dan Coats?
That was a great pause. And then what I liked the best was that when he came off the pause, the number of times he used the word, I believe it's a word, you know, he's like, even when he was talking, he was still struggling to find the language that would allow him to say, please let me out of this situation. I don't want to be here now. If we have to do this behind closed doors where, you know, I can actually tell the truth, that would be much better, but let me out of this. And so the other thing that I think that Congress should start to do with these guys, in fairness to them, because it's awfully embarrassing to be in that situation, maybe it should give them a safe word that they can just say if they're in a bad situation. You know, they just say, you know, like Rosebud. and then you're like, oh, okay, we're going to closed session now.
I like that. That's great. Let's just say make America great again. And go right.
You know what the safe word, you know the proper safe word would be? Or it would have to be a two-word phrase, John Dean.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Just have them say, if they say John Dean, then it's like, oh, got it. You're confirming that I've just asked you a question about which you have an answer, and that answer will be staggeringly damning toward the people around Donald Trump and perhaps Donald Trump himself. So we'll make a note, and we'll take that up in closed session. All you have to say is John Dean.
Is there a point here where maybe one of the most senior members of Congress, you know, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jim Sensenbrenner, should say something?
Look.
Where's the elder statesman here?
There ain't a lot of elder statesmen lining up, are there, right? I mean, to some extent, we presume that McCain and Lindsey Graham and a couple of younger members in the Senate, Ben Sasse.
Jeff Flake. And Lankford from Oklahoma has been surprisingly independent.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's a true believer. That's the thing. He's a true believer. And you know, and then in the House, you have some younger members like Justin Amash, as well as...
Walter Jones,
of course. But do you know what we've done here, though, is we've run through all these names. You haven't had anybody in leadership.
No.
Okay? Not in the... Obviously, McCain has a key committee, but you haven't had people in the specific positions. And this is where it gets very, very problematic, both in the House and in the Senate. The people who should be the constitutionalists, right, the ones who take very, very seriously the system of checks and balances, have long records of shredding the Constitution and dismissing checks and balances. And that's a challenge in this regard. Paul Ryan has never shown respect for the system of checks and balances. Mitch McConnell is actually openly at war with it. I mean, Mitch McConnell, what he did in the confirmation process, where he forced votes in order to protect nominees who were going to be in trouble, right? Showed that, you know, he was literally determined to undermine the advice and consent power outlined in the Constitution. He did not want it to come into play. He did this with Scott Pruitt at EPA, literally forcing a vote before information that everybody knew was
right.
going to come out.
No, I know.
Came out. Yeah. He also did it with Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce. Wilbur Ross had received a series of letters from members of the Senate asking him specifically about Russian ties to a bank he was involved in Cyprus and a host of related issues.
It all goes back to Russia.
including
Donald Trump's new lawyer. It all goes back to Russia. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation, thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
Pleasure, brother.